Welcome to The Dirty Inning, your favorite Phillies podcast about the worst, dumbest, most obscure, or most forgotten innings in Philadelphia Phillies history. I am Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight. With me is Dr. Trevor Strunk of Baseball Prospectus. Hello, Trevor.
I don't know if we can keep saying I'm from Baseball Prospectus. I haven't really written anything from them for a while.
Oh, I know. I just need something to accredit you to that is about baseball.
Because yeah, I know. My other podcast isn't really about baseball, is it?
Right. So I don't want people to think you're just an insane doctor that I've tricked into doing this. And
you've created out of pure.
You're just a bot.
Oh, yeah, this is my bot friend.
I've programmed. There's only people, if they go back, they'll see there's only a limited number of words you've actually said.
I actually have 100 words. It's not a good bot either.
Yeah, I'm not a good programmer. Like, it's very, very transparent. Yeah. Well, those are problems we'll save for down the line. But, Trev, right now in Philadelphia, well, I guess in Washington, but in either case, on the East Coast, we're just, you know, the rain is falling. The nights are humid and gross. Animals are dropping out of the trees and dying. It's just that disgusting time of year. You know, the carcasses, the fresh rat carcasses are sizzling in the afternoon sun. Everybody's just sealing their windows and throwing on the air conditioning, sucking yet another wave of life out of this planet through the energy consumption. I mean, it's just, it's brutal. It's a brutal time of year, that switch over from pleasant spring weather, which is about, what, like two, three weeks?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Into the wretched depths of swampy June. And what better time to record one of these podcasts about how just utterly incompetent the Phillies have looked at times throughout their history.
Yeah, especially given how incompetent the Phillies have been looking. I also, I mean, today in our non-distant history, but I also had the exciting pleasure of... you know, actually, I say pleasure, but I don't mean that at all. I found a... so we have this hat. I tore it all down in a rage. But we had this this flypaper up on our trees because of... are you familiar with the lantern fly epidemic?
I'm not familiar with that particular epidemic, please.
So lantern flies are basically these things that found their way here via Berks County because they had a shipment from overseas. And these tiny little guys were living in it. And what happened was they basically just ruin everyone's day.
They
live in trees and eat them and destroy them. They're very hard to stop. And they have no predators. Not here anyway. So we got ourselves a good old-fashioned invasive species. It's very cool. And yeah, no, it's awful. It sucks. And we have to basically, like... make sure we kill them all, and so as many as we can, so our tree doesn't fall down.
You heard it here first, folks. We've got to kill them all.
don't worry about context. Just tell that to everyone you know. The flypaper is like the way that most of the experts say to deal with it. Like, you put the flypaper up, and then the little larva, or not the larva, but like the nymphs, when they're like teenagers, crawl up and they die on that, which is good because it like. It basically means they can't mature. But the problem is you also catch some unexpected things. And I caught a bird in mine, which was really upsetting. I got it out by pouring vegetable oil on it, which is apparently the way you're supposed to do it.
Wait, you just dumped a bunch of vegetable oil on a bird and that got it out?
I wasn't that indiscriminate with it, no. I was a little more careful than that, but yeah, I basically like rubbed it on the places where it was sticking, and that gets it out.
What kind of a bird are we talking about here? Like
a songbird, not like an eagle or something.
Not it wasn't like, an ostrich. Oh, okay.
No, or an emu. No, it wasn't that. But I thought it was really hurt. It was really sad. But when I came out to check on it, because I called the animal hospital, I went out to check on it, and it had flown away.
Birds. Classic bird move.
Birds rock, man. But yeah, it sucked and made me really sad. And that's this time of year, for sure.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, everyone go out, check your bird traps. Make sure the right animals are in them.
Make sure you're killing the correct animals.
We all gotta eat. My parents set up the groundhog trap this year. You know, not to veer too far off topic. If anything,
no, talk about traps.
If anything, we're closer to on topic than ever. Frankly, I'm a little surprised there was an epidemic in the Philadelphia area that we hadn't discussed on this podcast yet. But yeah, my parents, they've taken a lot of countermeasures to keep groundhogs out of their garden. This year, it is a foot and a half fence that it goes a foot and a half into the ground, which is preventing them from tunneling in.
It's a straight up Trump wall.
They've discovered that, like the Trump wall, it is deeply ineffective and largely fiction in that the beings they're trying to keep out just came right in. And the groundhog was spied through a kitchen window and then hopped back over the wall once discovered. My father has determined that next year the countermeasures will involve electric wires running over the tops of the fence. But until then, there is
sounds extremely effective.
There's a small cage baited and ready to go to make sure this little nuisance can be safely trapped and humanely shot in the head with a former policeman's service pistol. Just kidding. Humanely released into the wild.
just two in the back of the head. That's the Clue family way.
Classic.
That's on your crest, right?
Yeah, a man slowly loading a policeman's service pistol, about to fire it into an incapacitated woodland creature's skull. Yes.
And it just says, two in the head.
Two in the head, you know they're dead.
You know what you've done. Actually, yours is better. But, yeah, no, it's a crummy time of year for that. It's like, it's a really, I don't know, it's gross in so many ways. I'll say that much.
Well, Trev, you mentioned that the current Phillies have been, let's say, underperforming to an extent. Morale is a little low, we'll say that. Or at least at times it's gotten low, which is, again, surprising for a team that's been in first place for so much of the year. But I think we could all stand to relearn a lesson or two on how this time of year is you know, anytime from April to June is still pretty early in the baseball season. Your old favorite local nine can really seem like they're blowing it, and then next thing you know, they turn the corner and break off a winning streak, and you know, just hope need not be abandoned just yet.
So this episode's about how one team did that.
It is not about that. I feel like these themes are alive and well in today's story, which is about the 1970 Phillies, for whom hopes were very mediocre. But after the beginning of the season, they started 3-0, much like our 2019 Phillies. And
yeah, remember when they did that and they were like, oh man, 3-0, this is the first time since like, I don't know, 19-dickety-2 that this happened.
Yeah, it was all kinds of incredible. But, you know, 3-0 start, that can happen, and it gets people excited. And
Orioles did it, too.
Hey, you know, see, that's it's just a magical, the beginning of the season where everybody's still on the board. It's a wonderful time, which is exactly why you can't just throw in the towel in mid-June. Yes, it's a little different from mid-April, but the 1970 Phillies started 3-0 as well. They then lost 6 straight, and that sent a different vibe rippling through the city, you might say. So on April 18th, 1970, they're 9 games into the season, about to play an afternoon game at Shea Stadium. And Trev, let's just skip to the end here and tell you that this was loss number 7.
Ah, well, I was assuming you weren't giving us a happy story tonight, Justin. That would not make a lot of sense.
I'm actually going to spoil the ending a lot here at the beginning of the episode and mention a couple of stats that jumped off the page at me. So the Phillies were playing the Mets at Shea Stadium, 1970. At this point, after they lose this game on April 18th, they hadn't scored on the Mets in their last 49 innings against the New York Mets.
Wow.
Going back to the previous season.
Oh, no.
Once they lost this game, they had played 64 consecutive innings without holding a lead. 64.
That's really bad.
That's over 4 entire baseball games, unless my math is off, right? No, wait. It's more than that.
Yes, 62. That's almost 9.
That's almost 9 games. Yeah. Yeesh. So they hadn't had a lead. I'll just edit that part out where I got that so incredibly wrong. I don't know why I keep rolling the dice with simple math off the cuff like that. I never get it, ever.
Listen, I was impressed by it.
Thank you. They would wind up going 5-13 against the Mets in 1970. They would leave the bases loaded four times in three games, including this game.
No, that's not what you want to do. You want to actually, generally, when the bases are loaded, here's a little. I don't know if we have any baseball neophytes listening or anything like that, but in case we do,
go ahead and throw a little backdoor stat at that.
Throw a little stat out there. Generally. It's considered good to score, to get a hit. I'll dumb it down. To get a hit when the bases are loaded. It is
a lot of people don't know it.
Very good.
A lot of people don't know it. You know,
no, it's hard. I mean, baseball is tricky. But when the bases are loaded and there are people on every base, a really, really good thing to do is get a hit.
Yeah, and but you might think with the bases loaded, where are you gonna put the next guy when he gets a hit? You know, that's why I think a lot of people think the inning is over once sure. The bases are low. There's nowhere else to go.
Yeah, well, I mean, that makes sense. I don't blame right. them for that. Yeah.
Yeah, but the truth of the matter is the runners actually advance from right. one base to the next, and they just return to home plate once they reach third. So that's the problem with bases loaded. It's just you get up there as a hitter and you're like, well, where the hell am I supposed to go? And you just give up. That's probably what was happening in 1970.
Yeah, and I think actually it's a lot of times what happens with the Phillies now. Like, I think the problem is that they are just too good of friends.
Mm. I think, that'd be tough to argue against. That the kinship that has been fostered in that locker room is now more of a curse because they're more focused on each other's feelings than they are, getting hits with the bases loaded.
Yeah, no one wants old Reese to be on third and then say like, I guess I got to go home now if you get a hit. You know, just let him stay in the game.
Yeah. No, I think anybody.
You think I'm onto something there?
Well, I think anybody would agree with you on that, Trev. frankly, and you know these 1970 Phillies, full of guys. This roster, guys who you know everybody got along with. You know, like the notoriously friendly and welcoming Jim Bunning. You know, the infamously friendly and reserved Larry Boa. You know, the intelligent and coherent Tim McCarver. You know, all these guys are guys you cozy up to, and you could talk for get a couple of cups of tea and just spend a rainy afternoon with a couple of these guys. And I'm telling you what, they're gonna be in your wedding party. So that's the kind of team the Phillies had in 1970.
They're just so fun.
Mm. Well. The stats didn't end there, actually. The opposition the opposition had scored on the Phillies in the first inning in four of their last five games.
Bad.
And the Phillies themselves hadn't scored a run in 19 innings. So things weren't great in Philadelphia.
Not good.
You know, just to set the stage even further, the season is 9 games old coming into this game against the Mets on April 18th, 1970, and that means that Frank Lucchesi, the new manager of the Phillies, his career as a manager in the big leagues was also 9 games old. And he was dealing with the fallout of being the skipper of a team that started what apparently was red hot at 3-0 and then dropped 6 straight and then had to face down the reporters who would come to find him and talk about all the typical narratives that you'd think Phillies beat writers would with that. This is that era that we've talked about before where the writing in the newspaper was very, very condescending.
Yes, yeah, super mean.
And just kind of mean towards the Phillies.
I love it. I mean, it's great to terrific. Read.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Entertaining sports coverage, but it's you just do think like I get why guys just stopped talking to the press in some cases.
Yeah, no, I mean for sure it's I wouldn't at that point.
No, you read a columnist who's just like, oh yeah, like making fun of how poorly you've hit, all the team's decisions, how high you wear your socks, just like, oh, I get not wanting to like hang out and cooperate with those guys either.
Yeah, like people are like, yeah, hey, Clue, Justin over here. You had 3 errors in the field. How did that make you feel?
I don't know. Bad. I felt.
And then there's a column that comes out that says, Clue, .. me .. bad. And you're just like, wait, I didn't say that. Not in those words.
Phillies, despite Justin, have no clue. There's your headline.
That's a good one. I like that. That's great.
Thank you. So Frank Lucchesi, who was hired in 1970 to be the fresh-faced new Phillies manager, he'd go down being a pretty beloved figure in Phillies history. He didn't last very long. He was the manager for 3 years. But he actually passed away just a couple of maybe 2 weeks ago, honestly. June 8th, wow. 2019, Frank Lucchesi passed away. Oh, and I remember seeing quite a few reflections on his passing, and he was clearly held in high regard despite his teams not quite being the successful teams of the back end of the 70s the Phillies got to enjoy. But yeah, poor Frank Lucchesi. First big league managing gig, and after 3 games, it was all working. Then suddenly, he's dealing with late buses. The Phillies' flights started getting delayed.
No.
The night before this afternoon game at Shea, they lost 6-0 to the Mets. And after this game against the Mets, which they would lose 7-0, they found the reporters went looking for Frank Lucchesi, and they found him in his office, just quietly scribbling on a yellow legal pad by himself, and speaking in what Frank Dolson of the Inquirer called a voice a bit lower than usual. And he said,
"That's so depressing."
Frank, this was a censored quote in the paper, so technically I'm just guessing what was said here, but Frank Lucchesi was asked, you know, what's going on? What's the team struggling with? And he was adamant that he liked this team, he believed in this team, but he did mention, you know, it's just that we can't get any fucking runs.
I mean, you got to feel for a guy at that point. Like, you just got to look at him and you're like, yeah, you can't.
I mean, you think about Larry Boa saying something like that, and it's said in anger, but I got the vibe, just in this case, it was just said very breathily or quietly, or just like, I just can't. Twice.
I just can't get any.
Twice in the middle of being interviewed. It really wasn't much of an interview. It read more like they were just like, hey, Frank, and he was like, hey, guys. And he just kind of like laid it out for him. And like two different occasions, he just trails off. He's like in the middle of a thought. One of their players, John Briggs, was expected to be a much bigger presence on the offense. And he had just like not been hitting well. And Lucchesi's just like, yeah. And I mean, just John Briggs. And just stopped talking. He probably like was like, oh, I don't want to like trash one of my players. I mean, he really did. He wasn't ready to jump down the players' throats. You could tell the press was
really impressive. Like, I mean, at that point, that's a big deal.
I mean, the season's only 10 games old. The press is like clearly trying to goad him into it. They're like, that's the move. That's what you got to do. You got to yell at him. He held a meeting after it was either after the previous night's game or before it, and he called it a quote prayer meeting. It was to tell his team that he believed in them and he wasn't panicking. Aww. And, you know, reporters asked him, like, have you ever had a losing streak this bad? Have you ever lost 7 in a row before? And he was like, no, it's never been this bad. But then he sat and thought and he was like, no, you know what? In the minor leagues, we did. We lost 8 games in a row. And I did scream at them. I did holler at them. But that was because they were a bunch of veterans and like they knew better. This is like a team of younger guys I feel like. I don't think that's what they need right now. Like, he actually had some thought into it. And I really like that it's, like, in his toolkit to have a meltdown, but he was like, I know not to use it in this situation.
Because, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I think that's neat. Like, it makes me think about, like, it makes me think about all the things that you can kind of get wrong as a manager. And, like, I think one of the big things you can get wrong is you just, like, you immediately jump to, okay, like, I'm furious. I need to like show these guys who's boss. I need to scream at them and yell at them. And like, I get the idea of doing that to show that you are in control, early on, especially in a season. But like the fact that he sort of understood like, no, there's like different kinds of in control here. Like I don't have to do that. I don't have to be that guy right now. No, it shows like a great, great level of, restraint.
Yeah, and you know, there's some managers for whom that's the only move.
Yeah,
and you know, that
Kirk
that
was... Gibson.
You know, Larry Boa. Yeah.
Wait, let's not say something we can't take back.
There's nothing that a little public shaming can't fix. Now, now get out there and let me throw this bat at your legs as you jog to your positions. Go,
oh, Larry. Oh,
stop, Coach. Stop crying. Yeah, that's the good stuff.
He's very cool.
Not Lucchese. You know, it was April 18th, and the Phillies had sadly broken their manager, a man whose Major League Baseball managing career was 10 games old. And, you know, again, he said, sure, I get mad. Yeah, definitely. But I'm the kind of guy, I hold it in for a while, and then, bingo. And the Inquirer finished that column after that quote by saying, stand back. It could be quite an explosion.
Oh, wow. So he's like a violent person.
It's more like they're saying if what he does is like stifle his anger and then blow up, this team is frustrating enough to make him blow up bigger than he's ever gone off before.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
But in any case, without the press goading him, Frank was able to probably relax a little bit. But clearly they wanted to walk into that locker room and see him throwing bats in the shower and threatening people's families, flipping the craft services table over, which back then, I guess, in the 70s, I imagine was just like pots of boiled potatoes.
The potatoes are everywhere. It rolls. There's no meat. There's just a bunch of rolls.
Right. And like cornmeal.
One of those big, like, you know those when they used to make, when they would make those, like, statues of butter?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Some of those. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's not that. Yeah. Classic 70s food. Little Herman's bean mix.
Ooh,
sure.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, sounding good. Nice pull.
I'm into this table now. I'm mad at him for tipping it over. That thing that he did for sure that we are not making up.
Well, Frank Lucchese kept his cool. But as I've said, clearly the Phillies did lose this game, so he had another loss to digest.
Did he keep his cool after that too?
Records indicate that he didn't really change his tune. But things were going to be a little if they had struggled in their last six games, things were going to be even more of a struggle on this night, and we'll talk about why right after this break. Well, Trev. The Mets were not going to take it easy on the Phillies and on April 18th, 1970, and it's easy to see why once you get a little context. We'll just mention at the start of the game, the Phillies' second baseman, Denny Doyle, came up to the plate and rapped a single to get the Phillies their first base runner of the day.
Nice.
It also got
I'm optimistic now. It's going to win, right?
It was the Phillies' last hit of the day as well. Mm. Though they did walk six times and yet somehow still not score. They actually walked four
times.
Seems
bad, Justin.
Four times in the first two innings, which, yeah, not great. And you know the reason for that, Trev?
I would love to hear it.
A little thing called 23-year-old Nolan Ryan on the mound for the New York Metropolitans.
You know, I always forget that Nolan Ryan was on the Mets.
As do I. This was the beginning of his career. This was Nolan Prime.
That's wild.
Yeah, he had yet to really achieve notoriety in the league, though the coverage the coverage leading up to this point on Nolan Ryan is right at the edge of that, though. This is the year that he was basically considered. Ryan appears to like have the stuff to like be the next great pitcher in the Mets rotation. You know, Tom Seaver's in there. We want now they got Nolan Ryan as an up and comer, and just like reading that, it was like, oh my god. Can you imagine having Tom Seaver on your rotation, but then also having Nolan Ryan, like your up-and-coming guy is Nolan Ryan? I mean, just looking at this. Like,
it does rock. It would be great.
In just the broadest sense, like once I realized Nolan Ryan was the Mets starter for this game, I got to like look back at a bunch of Nolan Ryan stuff and a bunch of Nolan Ryan stats. And honestly, the stat that freaked me out the most was none of the things he did on the mound. It was just that he played from 1966.
Oh. Yeah.
To 1993.
He played forever.
Forever. I mean, that's such a connection of eras that doesn't make sense to me.
It truly, it is wild how long he played.
I mean, I remember I would get his baseball card, like, when I was a kid, from the current season.
So how long was he on the Mets? I mean, I'll reveal myself as ignorant here. How long was he on the Mets?
Well, he made two starts for them as a 19-year-old in 1966.
Okay, and he was on the Miracle Mets in 69 then.
Right, he was with the Mets were the defending World Series champions as well at this point in 1970.
Okay.
So he was with the Mets until 1971.
Wow.
And really what's hilarious is that he put up some solid numbers with the Mets, and you could see where his strengths were. They were saying that his command and control were some of his issues at this point. The first year he leaves the Mets in 1972, he's on the Angels from 1972 to 1979. The first year he joins the Angels at 25
years
old. Again,
not a team that I associate with him at all.
Me neither, but he's, again, on that team for 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and in those 7 years, I believe he's an all-star in five of them, or it's 8 years and he's an all-star in five of them, including that first year he jumps from the Mets to the Angels.
Mets must have been feeling great about that.
Yeah, yeah, he led the league in shutouts with 9. He led the league in strikeouts with 329. But, you know, control issues continued to haunt him. He also led the league in walks with 157 and wild pitches with 18. So, but, you know, that was the first of many years that he received an all-star berth, Cy Young votes, and MVP votes. But 1970, he was still not a fully formed Nolan Ryan. And, you know, earlier in the month, he was rumored to be ready to join the Mets rotation, as I said, as a key starter for these defending champions. Tom Seaver's in place, Nolan Ryan's on the rise, which was interesting because one paper already showed that Nolan Ryan was thinking about the future outside of baseball already. The Rochester Democrat and Chronicle talked about they were doing a series on the 1969 Mets, and in the last entry of this series, they talked about the parade in New York. They talked about the speech Eddie Cranepole gave, and then afterwards, they talked about all the players departing and for the offseason, and they said Nolan Ryan, quote, returned to veterinary school in Texas. He wanted to become a cattle doctor someday after his fastball had lost its hop.
And did he do that? Is he a cattle doctor now?
I gotta tell you, my guess is no, but can't you also just see Nolan Ryan very casually getting up in the morning, whistling, picking up that air gun that Anton Chigurh has in No Country for Old Men, walking out
them
to the barn and just putting it right through a cow's head?
Yeah, no, I can see that. Absolutely.
Seems like the kind of guy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about him is you know he would enjoy it, too.
Quietly, casually.
Yeah, no, it's not a creepy... Well, I guess it's creepy, but it's not like...
He's not putting it in a headlock and Robin Ventura-ing it, you know, into submission.
He's an intense man.
And they're like, why are you killing all the cows? This is a cow farm. We need them. But no, that's you know, it's very easy to picture because of the very intimidating figure that Nolan Ryan cuts just in baseball history. And honestly, Trev, we read and talk about so many intimidating pitchers throughout history. We've talked about Bob Gibson a bunch of times.
We have.
Yeah, just guys like that.
I think Juan Marichal came up like 8 Juan times Marichal in our first few episodes.
Yeah, like a bunch of times in a row. Like guys who are genuinely intimidating, but we really only read and talk about them. Nolan Ryan, like I said, I remember him pitching while I was alive, which is, again, just blows my mind.
Yeah.
But because of that, I think it just adds to the intimidation factor for me because he was just, you know, the 7 no-hitters. Hearing that when I was a kid was like, that seems impossible. I started stocking, what's it called? I started squirreling away Nolan Ryan baseball cards every time I came across one, putting them in like little individual cases. I was like, this guy must be like the best baseball pitcher who's ever played just because of the what he was able to do. And I mean,
and as it happens, he's not far off.
Yeah, exactly. One of my childhood projections actually turned out to be pretty close to reality. Hitters.
Nolan Ryan's one of the best baseball players ever. I'm going to be a millionaire.
I can't believe it. I figured out I'm going to get rich. My parents like going into my room to clean it up or whatever, and I'm just like, get away from my stuff! No! You're trying to steal my money! My fortune! I, too, was an intense child. My favorite toy was a cattle gun. So, hitters of this era said that Nolan Ryan's fastball seemed to get a boost halfway to the plate, calling it, quote, like a stone skipping on a lake. Which, frankly, you know, that's just either that's a description you just don't hear anymore, or that's just not how people pitch anymore. I mean, do you know of anybody whose fastball gets life while it's on the way to the plate?
No, that's impossible to pitch that way.
You can't
pitch a
exactly
goofy ball.
That's impossible. That's from a cartoon. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's silly.
Versus the Phillies in his career, Nolan Ryan had
he's real bad, right?
It's not the best. He had a 3.43 ERA, 9.9 strikeouts per 9, 1.86 strikeouts to walks ratio in 39 games and 212 and a third innings. But what's wild about this, again, this is the span of his career. Nolan Ryan pitched 14 games at Veterans Stadium, but he also pitched 6 games at Connie Mack Stadium.
Oh my gosh, you're kidding me.
That is
wild.
It threw me for a loop. At Connie Mack, he had an 0.90 ERA in 10 innings. And at the Vet, he had a 5.52 ERA and 73 and a third. So the Vet was not kind to Nolan Ryan, one of the few places he didn't seem to have too much success.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so weird. Connie Mack and, wow.
Veterans Stadium and its parking lot like AstroTurf claims another victim. Veterans Stadium, undefeated.
It's like, it reminds me of those stats where it's like, so long to such and like, it'll be some pitcher that's retiring, and it'll be like the last person to pitch against both the Colt 45s and the Astros, and those always blow my mind no matter who it is. I was just like, are you, no way, like you can't be that old.
I mean, it's like it's the Julio Francos of the day, and I'm sure there's guys playing right now who will make it into an era they don't belong. But that's what it feels like. It's like you shouldn't be here anymore.
What are you doing here?
Get out. Yeah, I have mostly associate, and this is incorrect, but I, because of my age, mostly associate Nolan Ryan with the Texas Rangers.
Yeah,
he only
me too.
He only played 5 years with the Texas Rangers.
Was he also on? So, how many? What teams was he on?
So he was with the Mets for the first 5 years in which he appeared in Major League Baseball games,
okay.
Not full seasons. But 66 didn't appear in a Major League game in 67, and then 68 through 71, he's with the Mets. He's with the Angels from 72 to 79. Then he's with the Astros, which is where I think. I don't know. I was going to say that's where I think a lot of people know him from, but I think it's the Angels is where most people know him from. That's where he got the most recognition. That's where a lot of his awards came from. They certainly didn't dry up once he got to Houston, but he only made 2 more All-Star appearances with the Astros and then 1 more with the Rangers in 1989. And that was his last one. But yeah, he's with Houston from 1980 to 1988. And then he's with the Rangers from 1989 to 1993. He's with the Rangers. He joins the Rangers when he's 42 years old.
Oh my gosh, are you kidding me?
Yeah, he spent his 40s with the Rangers.
Hey, why not? There's no better place to spend your 40s than Arlington.
And by the time he's 44 in 1991, still leading the league in strikeouts per nine with 10.6.
People must have been so mad.
Yeah, that's infuriating. I mean, that's like a guy you create in a video game.
Yeah. I'd be furious if I was any other pitcher. I'd be like, why can't I have my turn?
I mean, at this point, people were still like, oh, I got to work those command issues out, which is something that, here's a little baseball secret, something they say about every pitcher who's ever existed, especially when they're young.
I love need to work the command issues out as a thing where it's like, yeah, I'm sorry, you're not throwing the ball perfectly right now, so...
Yeah, right, exactly.
You've become completely it's okay for us to get rid of you.
Is your fastball lower than 92 miles an hour? Well, he's got velocity issues. Did you walk 3 guys in a game ever before? Well, he's got control issues. And that's it. That's all a scout has to say when you're like a raw ball of baseball talent, 22 years old. You just finished like hitting 800 in your local high school team and striking out 12 to 15 guys a game. Then you get to like the point where they're scouting you and they're just like, command issues. Yeah, velocity's down. That's not what you want to see.
Wouldn't you be like so furious if you were a baseball player? Like in that way?
All the
like,
time, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'd just be so mad. Like, you don't know anything about me.
Stop talking about me. Yeah, I would say that a lot.
That's a cool thing to say. People love when you say, stop talking about me, and you're also mad.
And then I would brandish a cattle gun at the reporter. Get away from me! Just firing blasts of air into the locker room.
And they're getting scared.
Putting dents in the locker door.
They know that you're not joking.
Yeah, I'd be a real clubhouse hit, I think. Well, you know what? Nolan Ryan probably fixed those command issues by doing what he's famously known for doing, soaking his fingers in pickle brine to fend off blisters.
Yuck.
Trev, you ever...
No.
You ever do that?
No, of course. What are you talking about? No. I've never done that.
All right.
Have you?
Moving along. absolutely not. No. I wonder if it worked. But that's that kind of depression era thinking where you're like, well, this has to be good for something. Let's just stick our fingers in it and see what happens.
Throw out the pickle brine. That's wasteful.
What do you think? We're not going to need to brine something? You're never going to get a blister in your life?
Come on. Are you crazy? We need that brine.
Well, in any case, Trev, this is where we get to talk about America 1970.
Sorts of crazy stuff's happening then.
Yeah, it's a pretty wacky time, you know. Not everybody was just talking about Nolan Ryan's pickle brine or
most people were.
Frank Lucchese's crushing depression. But in 1970, there was like plenty of newsworthy events pretty much right on the day this game took place on April 18th. Trapped in outer space on a crippled vessel, the astronauts of Apollo 13 returned home safely.
Yay!
The smiling face of Richard Nixon showing them off to the press after their rescue and return planetside. Commander Jim Lovell admits that there were moments when he didn't think they'd make it, and having faced certain death in the dark cold of space, the mushy jowls and horse-like features of one of our most terrible presidents was probably quite the reward. Can you imagine picturing any other face while you were up in space waiting to be rescued, Trev?
I kind of want to picture any other face besides Richard Nixon waiting. I mean, wouldn't the dark vacuum of space be just, like, a lot nicer to come home to?
I would just be like, this can just be our home now up here. If we got to come back down there and like to get a bunch of photo ops with Nixon, which they had to, I believe they all met in Hawaii. Nixon flew out there and they all just got a bunch of like, oh, we did it. But, you know, not getting too far into it here, but Apollo 13, you know, reading about that and then that whole, the real life story of that is insane.
Apollo 13?
It is crazy.
Yeah,
that those men,
it's nuts.
Were alive at the end of it, especially in the 70s when I just picture everything being like analog. NASA, this isn't the case at all, but like, I mean, they were all using like slide rules.
NASA just has a bunch of like spools of magnetic thread. They're like,
right. I was going to say NASA was just like one guy with a joystick.
Ground control to Major Tom. Have you gotten our metal tape yet?
But I mean, that's just so totally unfair. It's more that they were like had to be even bigger super geniuses because they were like, we don't even have calculators and we got to get these guys home from space. So they're just floating in a non-functioning tin can.
I think it's fair to say that you're probably smarter than them.
what a time. But things planetside weren't too hot either, Trev, frankly.
Oh, no.
Especially in New York where the Mets played. New York State wanted to hire a, quote, super cop force to battle crime, according to the New York Daily News.
Always works.
I'm going to read that again because that's a real-life headline. Super cop force to battle crime. This is not the plot of a movie out at this time. This is an actual plan. The person chosen to lead this force would be free to move between New York State counties, ignoring jurisdictions, and conduct non-public hearings. Anyone who didn't answer the super cop's questions would be, quote, guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. What is needed is someone who can cross these boundaries as easily as the hoodlums, said one lawmaker in regards to this plan. Trev,
So they just wanted Judge Dredd?
Yeah. Honestly, it sounds like they were trying to recruit Charles Bronson from Death Wish. It sounds like they all just, like, as a group, a bunch of New York legislators went out and saw Death Wish and then came back to their offices and they were like, you know what we should do? And the other one was like, I was just thinking the exact same thing.
We should get that guy. What's that guy doing?
Trev, I mean, you know, a super cop force. Like, what happened there? I feel like we missed the boat. That just sounds like there's no way that couldn't have worked.
What's so weird about it is this idea that, I mean, what's so weird about it is thinking about that super cop force and then thinking about, like, do you listen to, you ever listen to Crime Town?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, so are you listening to the Detroit season?
No.
Oh, it's pretty good. I'm a few episodes in. But the what they talk about that is this thing called stress, which is a it's an acronym. It's not the actual thing, stress.
Oh, I see.
But it's basically a group of cops who are undercover and like they all carried weapons and would shoot on sight. Like someone would rob them and they'd just gun down people in the streets. It's like a completely crazy thing that happened. And it's just like they talk to some of the stress cops or like in a previous documentary and they're all just like, yeah, it was a really hard job. We were out there with all the animals on the streets. It's like, this man killed 12 people. It's like, what were we doing?
It was a really hard job to go out there with a gun and shoot people who didn't have guns.
This or maybe is horrible.
Yeah, it was a pretty brutal time, even just on planet Earth. Twisters were decimating Texas. War raged in Cambodia. And in San Francisco, Trev, a woman, according to the Philadelphia Daily News, was suing the city of San Francisco because in 1964, which is 6 years in the past, a cable car she was on had detached and crashed, which she said triggered a neurosis in her brain that drove her to have affairs with 100 men.
Cool.
That's the cool kind
of neurosis.
She said she had, quote, never thought of sex before the crash.
Oh, come on.
So I'm just going to open up the floor to any thoughts anyone has on this particular story.
I think she probably thought about sex before.
I feel like it crossed her mind.
I feel like at some point she like considered sex. She was just like, oh yeah, sex.
I mean, she was living in San Francisco. It had to have been like somewhere around her in some form.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like she was like, oh, I never thought of the Doors before now. Like, oh, you know, it's 1964. Like, oh, I just heard, Happy Together. I never really thought of the Turtles before. it's not that, I don't know, that's like a crazy thing to think.
Yeah, it's a crazy thing to think because it sounds like a superhero origin story with no, well, I was going to say with no heroics, but I guess like the, you know, for the 100 men she had affairs with, it was probably...
That probably was pretty cool for them.
Pretty cool, you know, yeah.
I bet they liked that.
I gotta
and you know what? It's okay if you like having sex. I mean, it's a little harder to say it's okay if you like having a bunch of affairs, I guess. But who knows? I mean, who am I to say?
I mean, who are we to say? I've never been in a trolley accident. Who knows what changes about people? Like, they get on the trolley, they're perfectly sane. They get off
the
trolley.
They've
never thought about sex like a normal person. They get off the trolley and they're a sex maniac. You know, that's just, I guess, apparently it happened. We can only assume, allegedly.
I think a central question I have for you, Justin, is have you ever thought about sex? Because I'm starting to worry.
I haven't. And frankly, I am so disgusted by that. I'm going to get on the nearest trolley and forget we ever had this conversation. Excuse me. Ding, ding. Well, weird place, America. And in Shea Stadium in an afternoon game, Denny Doyle rapped that infamous single off Nolan Ryan. And the Phillies took the rest of the day off.
Denny Doyle rapped that infamous single, Rapper's Paradise, off.
But we'll get to the rest of that game right after this break. Well, Trav, we know what happened in the top of the first inning on April 18th, 1970, when the Philadelphia Phillies were taking on 23-year-old Nolan Ryan and the New York Mets, their manager Frank Lucchese's sanity hanging by a thread.
Completely fly off.
Nolan Ryan, you know, those command issues came back to haunt Nolan
Ryan. It's good that the Mets got rid of him then.
He did walk four Phillies in the first two innings, which isn't great, but they didn't score, and he didn't allow any more hits the rest of the day. So it's fair to say he got past that single that led off the game pretty easily. And in the bottom half of the first is where we get a little dirty, frankly.
Oh, no. Hey, now, Justin, how long do you think it would take to walk that many Phillies over a series of games this year? I mean, assuming that Bryce Harper walks every time.
How long would it take to walk four Phillies?
Yes.
Like in minutes?
No, I mean like in innings.
Oh, I see. Well, earlier in the year, I would have said, dude, they could have done it in two innings. But right now, this is not a team that that can do that. I believe I saw Bryce Harper's walk total actually had dropped off significantly after he had jumped out to that huge league lead in walks. I think this. I don't think this lineup is intimidating too many people right now at the moment.
We haven't really talked about who was pitching for the Phillies on this day.
We're never going to get there. This is going to be the longest episode of all time.
Because it's not that it doesn't matter. It's just that, well, it does matter, frankly. Jim Bunning was on the mound for the Phillies this day. So Jim Bunning versus Nolan Ryan. This is actually what made me think, how long was Nolan Ryan pitching that he faced Jim Bunning in a game? Well, this was actually, you know, close to the beginning of Nolan Ryan's career, and it was actually very close to the end of Jim Bunning's career. But it's one of those times where two historic baseball figures happen to cross paths, being from different eras. You recall Jim Bunning, I'm sure, Trev, the cantankerous senator from Kentucky who in his post-baseball career years gave the middle finger to reporters and apparently didn't show much interest in government affairs that weren't baseball related.
That old racist.
Among other terrible comments he made in public. Well, turns out he was also a very famous, well-known pitcher, Trev, and a Hall of Famer.
Hang on.
A great one.
Come again?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's all true. Phillies retired his number and everything. But at this point, he was a baseball player who was also a stockbroker in the offseason, reading Barron's, a financial magazine, on team flights.
We all know what Barron's is, Justin.
You know, that that very famous financial rag.
I like imagining that, like, you're just, like, getting really into finance, and you're like, as a stockbroker, a person who sells stocks.
Grab me a Barron's, please. Stopping by the magazine stand, I'll take a Barron's. I imagine people said things like that back then.
I mean, you say you're saying it right now.
That's my thing that I say. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Going by the stand, grab me a Barron's. Make mine Barron's.
Make mine a Barron's. Sorry, I'm freeze framing. That's why it's silent.
I'm just enjoying it. That's why I'm silent.
This was a largely anonymous Philadelphia Phillies crew in 1970. They had not really established themselves too much. Obviously, people knew Jim Bunning because Jim Bunning, again, this is he would wind up retiring in 1971, but he was this was 1970, so that he was still a year removed from leaving baseball behind him. He had always said he would retire when he felt like he was no longer effective, and that feeling didn't cross his mind until after the 1971 season. He was 38 years old in 1970, but wow. He was one of those guys who looked like he was like 55 or 60, I think, for his entire life.
Right, which actually, in many ways, kind of a good way to live as a baseball player. Because everyone thinks you're old the whole time, so no one ever thinks that you're aging.
Right. You either look appropriately what your age is, or you are pleasantly surprising people.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So this was his second start of the year. He'd made another one on April 12th, in which he'd gone 9 1/3 innings and still lost 3-1.
That's a weird way to go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you're on a mission to pitch yourself to death, which every pitcher, I would say, from like 1980 and back was pretty much, that was their job.
Pitchers
like,
love to die.
Pitch till you die, they used to say. Get back out there and kill yourself for the team.
They did say very that, common. Didn't they?
Very common. So Jim Bunning comes out in the bottom of the first inning. And again, you know, there is play-by-play for this inning, and I did use it. But in trying to figure out what exactly happened, that was a lot tougher. The newspapers of the era kind of just went right on by this inning in describing what happened. But this is kind of where, you know, the Phillies would wind up losing 7-0. And this was they gave up. Jim Bunning would wind up, quote unquote, giving up 3 runs in the bottom of the first. It's only a 3-run inning. But, I'll just tell you what happened here, because Jim Bunning comes up, gives up 3 straight singles to the 1-2-3 hitters in the Mets lineup. Not good, but made worse by the Phillies defense. So just to rewind to Jim Bunning's last start on April 12th, his teammates had made 2 defensive miscues. In this game, they had three. That's I know it's simple math. Mm-hmm, just say that's
I'm listening.
But five errors by your defense and two starts. I mean,
that's a lot. Kind of
thing, that's the kind of thing that gets Jake Arrieta blasting his teammates in public, I would think.
And not with words, but with a gun, allegedly.
with a cattle gun. When Jake comes into that room with that, oh boy.
When Jake asks you if you feel lucky, friendo, you just like try and get out of the way.
Yeah. So the third single of the inning, Phillies left fielder Ron Stone made two errors on the same play, allowing two runs to score. So this is where this is what I'm talking about when I say this. I couldn't figure out what exactly happened. I know that it was a throwing error. One of them was a throwing error. So my guess is he screwed up the initial catch or the initial play in some way and then threw it absolutely terribly. And therefore, and like that was the 1-2 punch of incompetence that got those runs to score. But otherwise, I couldn't find a description. They all the newspapers, all the accounts, all the box scores, raps, all of them just said Ron Stone committed two errors, and then Tim McCarver committed the third error.
And it was actually, surprisingly for Tim McCarver, it wasn't him speaking up or anything.
Right, it wasn't a mental error. It was
it was a baseball error.
It wasn't a pronunciation error. It was an actual physical baseball error, which I believe he only had three errors on the season, and this was one of them behind the plate, which allowed a third run to score. Yeah, and again, that was a throwing error as well. So
he was a really bad hitter too. So it's not good for him to have errors. Not good.
Yeah, I would say in general, it is not good to have errors. Yeah,
you think so?
Yes, I'm gonna go yes on that one.
Weird.
That's the second chapter of my book on baseball. The first one being pretty much everything we just talked about in regards to the bases being loaded and how it's a common misconception that the game is just over once the bases get loaded.
That was the main. I feel like we need to do like a deep dive, like a serial style deep dive on that particular idea.
Right. Because you know it really just doesn't happen that often,
right?
And I think people are easily confused.
It's super confusing.
People are really stupid. You know, we can't all be 1970s joystick NASA guy. You know,
and I mean Justin and I are, but
right. Well, that's why we do this, to be able to explain the sport in a more in-depth way to our listeners.
Yeah, who aren't as smart as us,
right? So imagine you're Jim Bunning, you're 38 years old, the idea of retirement has floated into your head at some point because you're a year away from actually doing it, and you're out there trying to salvage what's left of your dignity and your career. You already pitched one game in which you went longer than regulation dictated and still lost. And your teammates backed you up by committing a pair of errors that cost you the game. And in this game, it's the third, it's the first inning, and they've already committed three more. One guy, two in one play.
I'm starting to think about what it would be like if I went into politics.
Right. Jim Bunning's just watching Tim McCarver's throw sail into center field, and his first thought is, I should get into politics.
I wonder what it'd be like being a big-time politician.
You know what I'm really good at is hating everyone. Like how I hate everyone right now in this moment.
He's just looking at everyone being like, I hate these guys so much. I hate a lot of people so much.
I could do that while wearing a suit. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm doing this. Actually, it's fun we brought up Jim Bunning's post-baseball career.
It is fun that we did.
Because his initial plans were... it was kind of a mystery. It was known that the Phillies had offered him, a year later, I believe October of 1971, he announces his retirement. Might have been September. I'm not looking it up. And
take that.
he's holding a press conference talking about how I always said once I felt like I wasn't effective, I would call it quits. I don't feel effective anymore. My only regret is that I didn't get to pitch in the World Series. And it was known that the Phillies had offered him a position, but no one really knew what it was. And Jim Bunning, refused to manage below AAA level. Like it was rumored, it's probably like a managing gig in the minor leagues. Well, the Phillies had Andy Semenek, managing their AAA team at the time. And Jim Bunning was like, I don't want to manage below AAA. And his explanation was because then you're just getting too far away from the major leagues. Which is a really simplistic kind of nonsensical.
It's a bizarre thing to say.
Why, man? Well, what happened was that Dallas Green, who was, I believe, an administrator with the Phillies at this point, it was either him and or John Quinn, where at this point there was some kind of misunderstanding. Jim Bunning thought that he was being told without being told that eventually the major league managing gig would be his, and that if he just, like, you know,
just wait it out, buddy,
for a minute, you know, we're going to dispatch of Frank Lucchese, or maybe he'll, like, you know, just wander into the desert.
Frank
Lucchese's
going to have a bit of an accident if you get my drift.
And that was apparently not the case. And he had been lifelong friends with some of the guys in the Phillies administration. And he just, you know, that abruptly ended, according to reports, after that went down. And
wow.
He did manage in the minor leagues. He managed away from the Phillies organization, but
he just stopped being friends with them.
Yeah, I mean, he seems like a pretty severe, dramatic guy. So it shouldn't be too surprising that he was willing to sacrifice friendships for not getting what he wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. It's just
after a perceived promise.
That's a little intense.
Yeah. Well, what was not intense was this baseball game.
Cool.
On April 18th, 1970. Jim Bunning lasted two innings. The Phillies lost 7-0. Nolan Ryan throws a complete game, strikes out 15, strikes out the side three times. The Phillies, you know, they lose this game. People are low. Nobody's feeling too good. But you know what, Trev? This is the lesson I think we should walk away from this game with today, because we all know Phillies in 2019 are just as capable of brutally losing a series as any team, even as good as I still think that they are.
Boy, you said it, Justin. They sure are.
But these 1970s.
Good night, everyone.
the next day, split a doubleheader with the Mets, and then you know what? They won six straight.
Wow.
Right after that.
Wow.
Came out the game, and you know what happened after that, Trev?
No.
Then they lost 10 straight.
Oh.
It was their longest winning and longest losing streaks of the season, and they happened right in a row.
That seems
exactly
very bad.
Exactly, in a way that with the wins coming first, the losses just kind of neutralized all that progress they made, and then, in fact, buried them further with the four additional losses. The 1970 Phillies were not going to win anything of note. They were 73-88. They finished in fifth place in the NL East. You might think that was last, but nope, they were second to last. They finished a half a game over the Montreal Expos. Mm. And, not great. They, looking at their season schedule, there was just no point where they put it together. They just...
Justin, I feel the need to ask you here, what is the lesson you were hoping that we'd get from this?
Oh, it was that any team can turn the corner.
But...
Good night, everyone. No, the, I will also add this. Trev, you know, only four teams had less than 100 errors in 1970. The Phillies had 86.
Wow. Even after this game.
Which was the least in baseball, according to the stats I looked at. To be honest, I looked at two different outlets for this. Baseball Reference lists them as having a collective 114 errors. But MLB.com says they had 86. So I went with the more positive one.
Okay.
And frankly, I think that's what that's
the right another lesson we can learn.
My lesson was basically that, yes, a team can start 3-0 and then lose 7 in a row, 3-7. And suddenly you feel like you're looking at a different kind of team. And then you know what? Next day, they can just break off six wins in a row without even batting an eye. And then, yeah, they can lose 10 games in a row. I think that's streaky.
I'm listening.
I think that's bad. I think the 1970 Phillies were just a different kind of bad. Is my lesson ruined? Yes, absolutely.
It's a little strange. I'll give you that. I wish it was a little more cogent, your lesson. Let me try and break it down. So it's going to be the end of this team. They are going to lose.
What I'm saying is anybody could win 73 games, Trev.
Yeah.
Folks, make sure you subscribe, download, and rate all the podcasts that are a part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hit and Season with John Stolness, Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, and this podcast, The Dirty Inning with Dr. Trevor Strunk and myself. You'll get plenty more episodes talking about just the most rampagingly stupid innings in Phillies history, as well as very brief American history lessons.
Yeah, we also have and complaints about various bugs.
We also have a Patreon. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/hiddenseason, where you can find all sorts of bonus content, including baseball movie reviews, trashy baseball romance novel reviews. John Stolness does a feature on baseball cards that he's very passionate about. He also occasionally does a This Week in Phillies History episode. We also do additional Dirty Inning content there. It's for $5. You get access to all kinds of new information that your life probably would have been better without. But no, make your brain heavy with Phillies facts, and you can live with the rest of us dragging your head along the sidewalk because it's too dense with information about the Philadelphia Phillies.
That's actually, we've been meaning to talk to you about that. That's elephantitis of the brain.
Yes, that's what we want you to leave with. Knowing that this podcast is so full of information, you'll get a disease. thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time on The Dirty Inning.
Goodbye, everyone.